like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Roxanne from Valley Center.
My name is Roxanne, and I am an alcoholic. Thank you for inviting me to be your guest speaker tonight. I've spoken at a lot of different meetings in San Diego, and I was actually participating in a meeting earlier today, so some of the people that are here tonight have already seen me today. So thank you for hanging out. John and Angela are good friends of mine. I've been sponsoring Angela pretty much from the beginning of her sobriety, which is always a pleasure to watch somebody grow and expand their horizons in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've sponsored a lot of girls over the years, but she's stayed, and I appreciate that. I got sober in October of 1983. It was October 31st, to be exact. Perfect for someone like me. I thought Halloween was the one time you could be deviant and no one was going to get mad at you. That wasn't always the case, but I did have a very wild party on Halloween night back in the late 70s at my home in Tucson, Arizona. And the next morning, there were pieces of costume everywhere. That's not too unusual. But what was unusual is the knock at the door was two Tucson policemen. And they wanted to know about a guy that had been at my party the night before. And did I know him? And I said, yeah, he's a busboy at the restaurant I used to work at. I was working at a different restaurant because when you drink like me, you have to move around a lot. And he said, did you remember seeing him last night? I said, oh, yes. And he said, do you know what happened when he left? And I go, no. I said, I barely know where I was when he left. And so we talked a little bit. And then he left, and a few hours later, he came back. Both times, I have to tell you, he had to get me out of bed because it was the night after, you know. And he said that the boy had left the meeting, gone to a bar, and hijacked a girl's car with her in it, killed her, put her on the side of the road, and he was on his way to Texas when he got pulled over again, and they arrested him because he confessed because he was drunk and didn't know what he was doing. And I thought, oh, my God. He was at my house. Like, stuff like that happened all the time. It was no different than anything else. I mean, people didn't get murdered all the time because of my parties, but things happened, you know? So I was a lucky alcoholic in many respects. I was told early on in Alcoholics Anonymous not to tell this part of my story to the girls in jail that I was taking the message to because they would resent it. Because I got pulled over a lot for my drinking. I drove a red sports car with Roxy on the license plate, and I drove drunk. So of course they're going to pull me over. The thing was, in my opinion, was that I was a competitive gymnast for most of my life, and I was able to do the balancing acts pretty well. And so that was the simple things, you know, touch your nose and stand on one foot. And I could pretty much do that kind of stuff. Don't ask me to do the alphabet backwards or whatever. I never had to do that. But they would say, take it easy going home. Sometimes they'd follow me to make sure I was going to be okay. But I never went to jail. And I was just lucky, just lucky. So I kind of jumped into the middle of my drinking. But I want to tell you that my father was a Marine my whole life. And that's some good about that and some bad about that. He was definitely an asshole. I said that on the tape. You can edit that out. Okay. But he was a Marine, and he was that kind of a Marine that ran his house and his children like boots. And so growing up, it was unfathomable to do something that was against the rules, and yet I spent the good part of my childhood breaking every rule that man put out there. So to say things were a little bit strained in our family because of my behavior is an understatement. So Dad's a career Marine. We moved every 14 to 16 months. My father was a pistol and rifle expert. He was an Olympian pistol and rifle shooter. He was distinguished in his career, and I set about to ruin his career in many respects. So as a child growing up, I was able to maintain a GPA that was satisfactory to him, but there were other things that were going on. The good thing is, by the time I was a senior in high school, the gas rationing had occurred, and nobody could get gas, and we lived at the rifle range, because that's where my dad worked. And the rifle range meant that I took, you know, two buses and a boat to school, practically, to get to school every day, and I had my driver's license for a while, so I was allowed to drive the car, but the gas rationing was kind of preventing that. So my mom and dad decided they were going to put me on Main Side with some friends. And it was on. I just opened that window and slid out almost every night of the week. So I just slid out and I'd meet my friends, get a little toked up, drink a little beer, whatever else they had. And that was the way I did my senior year. Now, mind you, still maintained the GPA, still doing all the school activities. I was a high school cheerleader. I was a high school gymnast. I was a high school track star. At all field events, and I was able to do that and kind of just keep people at bay just with my activity level, and then, you know, still going out every night and drinking. My biggest goal in my life at that time was to make it to college, and if I could make it to college, I was just going to be okay. And college was quite the experience for me. I graduated from high school in North Carolina. Again, I told you, by the time I graduated from high school, I had been in 14 different schools. So I knew how to make friends. Usually you make them through sex, drugs, or alcohol. And I knew how to use those to make friends. So my first semester in college back here in California, my parents had owned a house in California, even though we rarely lived there. And so we'd moved back to California. My dad was going overseas. He went to Vietnam 4 times. I think it's because he had 5 kids and wanted to go. But So we're back in California. I start school, and I don't know how to control and enjoy my drinking. When I don't have anyone watching me, and I don't have any place to be, and I don't have any commitments, I get in trouble. So it just started that way. I can make the grades. I'm an art major too, and some of that's not going to make. I'm kind of bohemian at this time, so I have this conservative side because of my folks and my dad, but I also have this other side that just wants to drive a Volkswagen and be a hippie and that sort of thing. So I'm an art major, and I have some talent, although my art teacher in high school said when I won the governor's award for some paintings that I had submitted in a show, he said, "What are you going to major in college? Cheerleading?" Because he couldn't keep up with my activity schedule, like all the things. I was always trying to get out of class and, you know, mess around all the time. So I had that in the back of my head that, yeah, I kind of have to get serious here if I really want to do art. And so I'm in college, and I'm actually finishing my art projects in the car before class because I don't have time to keep my social life alive and my drinking alive and still be an art student. But, you know, we do what we have to do. Most of us did it. You guys might have been married and had kids and did it. Some of you were trying to hold down that job and do it. Me, it was just like, you know, how can I get the, you know, my projects done, stay on the dean's list, you know, get everyone to, you know, to pretend to everyone that everything's okay. Probably one of the biggest mistakes I made was right in the middle of my college, I decided to get married. And I'd met a really nice guy, and I set about to ruin his life. And I didn't want to ruin his life, but that's what I did. I just bulldozed you. And I want what I want. Okay, and someone said that to me when I first got sober. It's like, you can't say no to an alcoholic. If you said no to me, I would figure some way to undo that no. And I would ruin everything to get that no undone. So, and he was like that. I mean, he was a super nice guy, but sometimes he'd have to say no. No, we're not going out tonight. You went out last night, you got loaded, and, you know. I mean, so I'm in this marriage, and I think I was married in September. I know I was married. I was married in September. In December, I'm in bed with someone else, and I'm thinking, something's not right here. And my girlfriends in college, they were still in college because I'm still trying to go to school and stuff, and I'm at Fullerton, which is weird thinking about that. And they would say, aren't you engaged or aren't you married or, you know, that kind of stuff. And I'd be like, ah, you know, whatever. And whatever. So fortunately, I had the wherewithal to cut him loose. And I went off to Arizona. I had gotten a scholarship, and I was off to U of A. Fast forward to the Halloween party, you know, someone's dead, and he was at my party, and it's like, what's going on? Arizona, being away from my folks, being away from that marriage, being away from certain people, I was remaking myself, but I wasn't making myself into somebody better, and it's not pretty. In the end, if we just go there right now, I'm in a blackout. I'm smoking cocaine in a hotel room with Mexican nationals who were my coke dealers and stuff, and I'm not doing well physically. I'm not doing well physically. And a couple people have mentioned my drinking, but no one's going to tell me no. You know, I don't accept that. One guy said, what's that perfume you're wearing, Chivas Regal? And a flight attendant back from a trip to Mexico, which was one of my go-away places, go away and get straight places, which never worked. But he said, he was kind of flirting with me on the plane. And then I said, are we going to dinner? And he goes, you're too drunk. And then calls me 2 weeks later. And I happen to be sober. I hadn't started drinking yet. And he says to me, you are a different person when you're drunk. And I was like, you're like, really? So little things like that were happening. So I'm in this hotel room, and I don't know really everyone that's there, but I'm in a blackout, and I call my mom. Don't remember anything about that, but my sister calls me and tells me everything that I said. And so she said, Mom's coming out to get you. And I go, what? She says, yeah, she's in the Volkswagen. She's going to get all your stuff. You're coming home. And I go, no way. She goes, you better be ready when she gets there. So I'm living a double life, too. They have no idea how bad it's gotten, you know. I'm still the kind of person that wants to hide my ashtrays when my parents come over, even though everybody knows I smoke, you know. It's like so weird. So I just lived a lie for a long time. And she takes me and puts all my stuff in storage, puts my car in storage and everything, and she says, get in the car, and there's a six-pack on the driver or the passenger seat. And I said, who's that for? She goes, you. And I go, I don't drink beer. And she said, you will. And I did. She'd been going to Al-Anon. Oh my God. So she takes me home, and she's really cool, though. It was a little too cool. So my mom's not really that cool. And she's like, maybe you should see your doctor, the doctor that I used to see before I left and dumped everything. And he happened to be head of Scripps, La Jolla, the alcohol unit. Yeah. Serendipitous? I don't think so. So he diagnoses me alcoholic. I still don't believe it. And he's actually giving me a checkup that's female in nature. And I'm like, how do you tell that from that? You know, how do you know I'm alcohol? I mean, like, you're looking at something weird here. And he's like, he goes, no, I've been talking to your mom and stuff. So he said if I didn't stop drinking, I was going to die. And I was like, really, that's a little severe. He said, how did your grandmother die? And I went, oh, my grandmother died of alcoholism when she was 64 years old. In a hospital, you know, someone took some booze into her because she was going through withdrawals. She drank it and she died. So I said, okay, whatever. So the gig's up. And I told my mom, okay, I'll go to a meeting. And I wasn't that crazy about going to a meeting, but I did anyways. And to make that story, that's at the beginning of October. And at the end of October, I'd been to maybe four meetings, and I hadn't stopped drinking, and I wasn't taking it serious. But a girl did take me downstairs in the basement, so we were having the meeting upstairs, and she took me down, and she showed me on a chart, on a piece of paper, she said, this is you stopping drinking, if you stop drinking today. And this, if you stay sober, you're just going to go along like this. But if you drink 10 years from now, you don't get to start over here. You go back to here. No, You don't get to go back to where you were when you stopped. Your drinking will have progressed whether you drink or not. Your alcoholism will have progressed. And I was like, really? I was blown away by that statistic. And I got to thinking about that. So Halloween weekend comes up. I told you I like that deviant holiday. Some of you do too, I know. And I party with an old boyfriend comes into town. He comes in on a fast boat. You know what he is. And we have a lot of fun, F-U-N-N. And I am so bad that weekend that my sister won't even look at me. And she's like, you got to make a decision. And I remember I partied Friday night, Saturday night. Sunday's my recovery day. I just have to drink a little bit just to kind of be even. And I ask her to meet me for a drink, and she says no. And then she shows up anyways, and she won't drink with me. And there's an exchange of words. It's not very pretty. And then the next morning, I decide not to drink that day. And when I don't drink that day, I think about things. So I go to 3 meetings that day, morning, noon, and a night meeting. Next morning, I don't drink all day that day. And the next morning, I do the same. And my prayer is very simple. I think I won't drink today. Will you help me? That's it. I almost do that prayer even today. It's a little changed up a little bit now. There's more gratitude in it. I said, thank you for keeping me sober today. Thank you for everything you've taken. Thank you for everything you've given me. But thank you for everything you left me with, because you're still teaching me. So it's a little bit different, but it's basically very simple about me not taking a drink today. And I did it for a while. I wasn't doing very well. I was still going to meetings and stuff. I hadn't got a sponsor. I hadn't done any of that. But I ended up going into Serenity House in Escondido for a while. And my grandpa said he would pay for it. Oh, I forgot to tell you, my grandpa was sober in AA. I didn't know that at the time, but it was really cool, and he thought it was the greatest thing that I was getting sober. And he was paying for Serenity House, and I was there for a while, but I can't follow the rules. And it's going to be a long time before I can. And Serenity House has a lot of rules. So one of them is not to meet any guys at meetings and not hang out outside and talk the whole meeting. I don't know why they have that rule. But so the girls that were at Serenity House that were there with me all told on me, because that's how girls do it. And I ended up getting in trouble, and they called me in and they kicked me out. And I was like, oh my God. So my first, I'm 90 days sober, give or take, and I'm kicked out of Serenity House. My parents are pissed off, and I got a resentment, And not to make a big deal out of this, but I was kind of wishing those girls would all drink or something, and I was going to stay sober, and you guys are all going to get drunk. And I really stayed sober that way for a little while. So one of the things that I have to tell you that was made the difference between me being just a wench in AA was that that boy that I had met at that meeting, he said, I'll pick you up. I'll take you to this meeting. This is my home group. I want you to introduce you to a few people. And basically, here's what he did. See that girl and that girl? Pick one for your sponsor. And I picked the skinny one, because I'm vain and shallow like that. And I had no idea what the steps were or anything. And it turned out she was just a rock star in AA, but I didn't even know. I never even gave her oh my gosh, I got this. Because I didn't know. I didn't know she was great, and she was everybody's sponsor, and she was the chair of the roundup, and she's this and she's that. All I know is that when I became her sponsee, I got busy because she made me. I remember her asking me to be a greeter at the roundup, and I was to bring cookies, wear a dress, and pay the $5 registration. Back then it was only $5. And I said, oh, I'm bringing cookies. I have to pay too. She goes, AA is not free, And I was like, oh, my God. So that was really my first introduction to service. And yet, most of you know that I'm really into service now. So how do I get from, I got to pay, to, I love AA, and if it wasn't for service, I'd be drunk today, So there's this whole long history. I always want to tell the GSR story, because I was a GSR just like everybody else. And, well, how many of you have been a GSR? Raise your hand. Well, few of you have been a GSR, so a few of you. So I was a GSR, and I wasn't very good, but I have gone to the same women's group for a really long time, and they needed a GSR for weeks, and finally I just went, oh my God, I'll be the GSR. Didn't know anything about it. In fact, my sponsor wasn't really big on general service, even though she was friends with a past delegate that we all know named Bobby. And Bobby and her were really good friends, and Bobby never talked to me about General Service, but I'm here, I'm doing GSR. And but Paul C. was into General Service, and then Paul C. ultimately ends up being my service sponsor, and then things really got busy. So being a GSR, I stayed GSR for 3 rotations. That's 6 years at this meeting I was a GSR. No one wanted that commitment. I took it, and I got better and better. In fact, it should be a 6-year commitment because it takes you that long to learn what the heck's going on. You know, 2 years, not long enough. So, and the best kept secret is that the GSR becomes a GSR, doesn't know anything, and yet they're supposed to go to 5 assemblies a year, a district meeting every month, they're supposed to join a committee, and they don't tell you any of that stuff. You have to figure it out on your own when they say, how come you haven't been going to the assemblies? And then you're just like, I don't know, what's an assembly? You know, I've been a GSR for 2 years, didn't know what an assembly was. So it's rough. So we do really good orientations now at the assemblies for these GSRs who finally make it there. So I got busy in AA. I was really involved in the roundup. I loved being in the roundup. I was chair of the Young People's Committee. I was quite young. And I got to go to bars and look at bands because we didn't have DJs back then. So we didn't have cell phones back then, so, you know, we didn't have anything. So that was fun to do. And then some of the other areas, I did H&I, went and not told the girls in the prisons that I had been pulled over many times and never got a, you know, I had to be really cool about that. And then when you would always ask them, I would ask the girls in the prisons, how come you're here? And they'd say, I was kiting checks, and I didn't even know what that was. And I was like, oh, okay. But then when I was telling my sponsor about it, I said, they're just in there for kite and checks. She goes, honey, they're in there for a lot more than that. I was naive about that. So I got active in a home group. I think everyone should have a home group. Raise your hand if you have a home group. Okay, good. You should have a home group. You go to as many meetings as you want, but always come home. And I have been to AA meetings all over the world. I travel quite a bit now. Oh, I forgot to tell you. When I was 35, I became a teacher. And it took a long time for me to be a teacher, but I've been teaching in the public sector for 27 years. So if there's any of my students out there, you know, you never know. And a lot of my students needed this program when they were 13. I'm a middle school teacher, so they were sick. And teaching eighth graders is just like teaching alcoholics. They are so self-centered, just to the core. And so it taught me a lot. In my 10th year of teaching, I was nominated to be Disney's Outstanding Teacher in the area of humanities. Remember I told you I was art? I taught art. And I was bestowed with $10,000, which is kind of a nice gift. The school got $5,000, and I got to be the Disney teacher for a whole year in my district. And what I learned about that is ego is a really big thing. And even though I had ego playing with me in AA, I wasn't really recognizing that ego was having a problem with it in AA. But it really became apparent that my ego was out to get me. And when I was thinking that everybody at school should really revere me because I was the Disney teacher, for crying out loud, don't they know who I am? And I was on the front of magazines, and I got an APB, you know, news thing, and, you know, San Diego teacher does this whole thing. And I got to go to Orlando and Anaheim and speak and pretty much say things like, thank you to all my friends at Bill W. for helping me remember what it used to be like, you know. And then a lot of Hollywood is AA. I don't know if you guys know that. A lot of Hollywood is. In fact, my husband just sent me a YouTube of Anthony Hopkins speaking at the Pacific Group. Have you guys seen that yet? Yeah. Full face. I mean, come on. Where's our traditions and all this? But anyways. So a lot of AA is happening in Hollywood. And again, that whole thing was a wonderful experience to be involved in. I know the only way I became a Disney teacher was because I was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they told me to suit up and show up, and I did that. And I did it well, and I did it because I was told to do it. And my teaching career was just an amazing adventure for me. I did not... Well, let's just put that through. So I have welcomed a few of my former students into AA. It's usually like this, like when they see me, and I'm like, and then they go, oh, like, I get it. So after I was a GSR, I was telling you a little earlier, I got to be DCM of my district, and I was DCM for District 23, which is the newest district in the area. So when you're a new district, you kind of get away with a few things, and so I had a great experience with that. But right in the middle of my DCM experience, they needed an IT chair, and because you're a teacher and you work with IT every day, they kind of asked me if I could chair that committee. And after chairing that committee, I was selected to secretary the area committee. And so as secretary on that assembly board, I was finally learning how to shut up. And by not listening and just typing the whole meeting, not talking, just typing and listening to everybody else's reports, I got to figure out how this thing was done. And I got to figure out how AA has been held afloat for 81 years. 81? What? The big book's 81. So we were going on our 85th international, so 85 years next year. So, okay, so figuring all this out, and being a secretary for 2 years really helped me do that. Then I got to be, I stood for chair and I got it. In some areas, the delegate rotates out a delegate into chair, but we do chair first. That's our rotation's a little bit different. So I did chair and then I got alt delegate with, and I stood with Jane. Some of you guys know Jane. And then I became delegate a year ago. So I've been a delegate for a year. I've been to two conferences now. I'm very excited to be a past delegate. This week alone, I've had 5 reports that I've made to different districts and areas or groups around. I'd be happy to do a report at this group if you ever want it. The conference has taught me that AA is very big, way bigger than me, and that we are doing a great job at bringing the message of Alcoholics Anonymous and sobriety to as many people as possible. Where am I at?
You still got plenty
of time. Okay, good. I just want to make sure. So one of the areas of general service that I really like to talk about is some of our outside issues. And one of the outside issues that I get a lot of flack about is Grapevine. Grapevine has, they put out an issue every month, and a lot of the articles in there aren't specifically talking about alcoholism. Anyone can write an article to Grapevine, and Grapevine will publish it if they feel like it has an audience for that particular story. This month's Grapevine is an African-American issue, and we do this periodically. So next month's will be young people. So September is devoted to young people. August is devoted to African Americans and blacks in AA. And then we have one just for a prison issue. We have the holiday one that comes around, you know, Christmas and Thanksgiving. So they take articles 6 months in advance. So when you're writing your article in June, it's going to be for the December issue if it gets accepted. Some of the articles that I write are are put into archives. They'll go, okay, good article, can't use it, and they file it. And then, you know, 4 years later, it comes out in Grapevine, and I'm like, I can't remember writing that article. And so I'm published in Grapevine, and this month in the African American issue, I'm published. And I'm like, wow, that's weird. Well, I'm not African American. But, you know, they needed something to fill something. And sometimes the articles, like, they'll give you a parameters, like you can write a 300-word article or a 600-word article. So I'm a teacher, so I kind of know what people want. And I'm a speech coach, so I kind of know how do you do a beginning, middle, and end. And so my articles tend to get a little more airtime, if you will. So I got notified not by Grapevine that my article was published, but by a delegate chair from the Panel 68 conference. So I went to the conference and got elected chair. There's only 13 chairs out of the 93 delegates, and now we're all kind of friends, and we have a little text strand that we text each other about what's going on in our area. So someone from that text strand says, hey, I liked your article. And I was like, what article? So they saw the article before I did. And maybe I wasn't all about reading the African American issue, thinking, okay, Vera's article is probably in there, because I know Vera had written an article for the newsletter, and she's the delegate from Oregon, and she happens to be Black. But so I go in and I say, oh, yeah, there's my article. But in that magazine, there are five people from Area 8, our area, published in that article, in that magazine. One's got a joke. Two have letters. They just wrote grapevine letters. And then I have an article and someone else. Two, three, four, five. Five. Five Area 8. It's pretty impressive when you think about it. And I don't comb through all the grapevines like it seems like I do right now, looking for everybody's name. But some people do, so they'll notice it. Grapevine now now puts all of the articles on audio. So you can hear the story read to you on an MP3 or phone or something, or your car radio, depending on what you have technologically. And that, so I had written an article a long time ago, and then I'm driving down the road one day, and a friend calls me from Kansas, and he says, I'm listening to your article right now. And he didn't wait till the article was over to call me. He's listening to it right now. So he doesn't know that it's Roxanne from Valley Center who wrote the article. He knows because the people in the article, Phyllis, my sponsor. So he figures out that this has to be Roxanne because of the article. So my article in this month's issue talks about that, talks about how AA works and how our lives intersect. He lives in Kansas now. He used to live here. And our lives intersect, and all this really weird stuff happens to us where we can go to Scotland for an AA meeting and run into somebody. I was at the conference the first year I was a delegate, and they have you have a meeting down at on Riverside Drive, down in the bottom of GSO, the basement. Anyone been to that meeting before? It's on Fridays, and it's an 11 o'clock in the morning meeting, so it's unlikely that everyone's gone. But if you ever get to New York, go to that meeting on Friday. It's awesome. So they had a guy speak. They usually have somebody share a little short share, and then everybody gets up and participates. So I'm waiting for the meeting to start, and there's the front rows, all these guys, and I went, hey, hi. There are guys from my home group, guys I smoke cigars with. I do that sometimes. And so the first thing they said to me is, say, what are you doing here? Like, they're the only ones allowed to go to New York. And I said, I'm here with the conference. And they go, what's the conference? That's funny. Because everyone knows what the conference is, right? That's where the delegate takes all the voices of Area 8, all you guys, tell me what's up with Google and YouTube and other social media platforms. And then you say, no, we're not going to do that. Like, we're going to get a fifth edition big book. And then I come back and say, no, we're not. Because that's what happened at the conference. So I take your voice to the conference in New York, and we all vote on how we're going to handle the changes that are coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. Does that explain it pretty well? Okay. So there's a lot more to it, but in a nutshell, the delegate is your voice in New York. And we do it every year, and at a great expense, by the way. Expenses are going to be changing because we're moving out of Manhattan into Brooklyn. We go to Rye one year and then Manhattan the next. And now instead of Manhattan, we're going to Brooklyn, which is going to save thousands of dollars. And we'll still have the same conference for as long as we can, I guess. So there's lots of talk about the conference rotating into different cities, but that never happens. Everybody wants to go to New York and because of the General Service Office. So, I became a teacher when I was 35. I told you that. And 10 years later, I was a Disney teacher. But in between all that, I married a really nice guy. Here's how that happened. I'm dating a guy. He's a Marine, super nice. And I'm going to AA. I'm 2.5 years sober. I'm super busy. Everything's rocking. And we get engaged. And before the engagement can even, make it to the wedding plans, I get pregnant. And so I hear that happens sometimes in AA. And I get pregnant, and we kind of have this conversation, and I'm older now, and I know better, but I'm going to have the baby. And he's like, yeah, I'm not sure if I want to do that. And I said, that's up to you. And so there was this little decision-making thing happening. But meanwhile, he goes on recruiter's duty in Arizona, which is where he's from, and he's driving to work in the morning and gets involved in a car accident and dies. And my sponsor comes to me that day, and she says, she calls me and she says, can I have a cup of coffee with you? And I said, sure, kind of weird. But she comes by and she doesn't even sit down. She goes, Joe died today in an accident, and I just wanted to be the first one to tell you. And I was like, what? He's in Arizona. He's not even here. And she goes, oh, yeah, he died in Arizona. So it was really weird. And the Marine Corps is pretty cool about that. They send the chaplain out and all that. But he had a lot of close friends, and one of his friends was Mike, and they had a firewood business together. So Joe and I lived together, and then Mike and him had the firewood business at this little place we had in Vista. And I'm pregnant, and I stayed pregnant. And so Joe died in May, and about September, Mike's asking me to marry him. And I'm like, what? You're crazy. I'm not going to marry you. And he kept asking me, like every time he saw me, he'd knock on the door and he'd say, I'm here to sell some firewood. Will you marry me? And I'm like, just sell the firewood. I'm not marrying you. So I end up having that baby, and he was there, you know, the pacing the floor and all that happy stuff. And he stayed there the whole time. My mom and dad are like, hey, Mike's here. And I said, I know, it's weird, huh? And he just was very tenacious, and we got the baby home and everything, and he goes, you should marry me now. Oh, that's right. I had this lawsuit going with the guy that hit Joe, and I had an attorney, which used to be somebody I did drugs with, but, you know, we don't have to know that, and in Arizona, but he was good, and so we were suing for rights for the baby. And it was really the first time it had ever been done in California. And I got full VA, full Social Security, and then a little trust fund as well. So everything worked out there. But the process to get there was very invasive. They asked you some really personal questions. And Mike's kind of a traditional guy. He's like, you don't need to do that. If you just marry me, you don't need any of that. And I was like, stop it, right? So then he says to me after the baby's born, I really want to take the baby and show her to my mom. It's a little girl, right? And I said, okay. And he goes, so we get to Texas. I go with him to Texas and meet his parents and all that crazy stuff. And we're at, it's Christmas time because she's born in December. It's Christmas time and we're at Best Buy. And he says, come here, I want to show you something. And he takes me to the ring counter and he goes, I really want to marry you. Like that? And I said, yes, in a moment of weakness. And we've been married 32 years. And, which, I never did that. And I'm a terrible wife, too, by the way. Terrible. I'm gone all the time. I'm always helping alcoholics. I'm always bringing really creepy people home, you know. And he still loves me. But we ended up having four kids. Four kids, me! It's like, I didn't have my first one until I'm 30, right? So all those kids are kind of grown. My youngest is 22 now. But, boy, I should have talked more about them because they can really tell an AA story when you got kids. Because those kids, I'm breeding alcoholics, right? I'm populating the room with alcoholics. But it keeps me in service. It keeps me, I have to keep this program alive because they're going to need you. So one's already 5 years sober. She started getting sober, going to meetings at 17, went to rehab at 18, year-long, 18 months of rehab, spent her whole trust fund on rehab. And then one's a practicing alcoholic, so not drinking today because she's had some problems with her drinking. And she's one of those ones that she'll stop drinking to lose weight. You know, like she's completely fit, like total vegan fit, you know, won't eat anything bad but drinks like a fish. So funny. And then the third one just left a cult a year ago. He stayed in a cult for 5 years because his drinking was so bad. He thought, I got to go. It's like someone joining the military because of their drinking, or getting married because of their drinking. That was like, so he joined a cult because of his drinking and on other stuff. And he came out last year, and nobody thought he would come out of that cult. 5 years, that's a long time to be in the Yellow Deli cult. And then, did I say that out loud? It's on tape. So you don't want your kids to go there. It's bad. And then the young one is the only one that's not showing any true signs of alcoholism. But I came home last night from an AA commitment, and there were all these little mini red cups, you know, the little shot red cups. All of them stretched out. They all had a lime in them. They were all completely empty, and a big bottle of tequila completely empty. And I went, okay, this is how we roll here. So he's just home from college. He goes back to school on the 23rd or something, and I'm kind of happy about that. So we'll see what happens. Alcoholics Anonymous is the best thing that ever happened to me. I would never have been a teacher. I would have never been a mother. Oh, my God. And I would have never had the experiences with people that I've been able to experience today. I'm so grateful to this program. Thank you so much for having me come and share with you tonight.